said Professor Quirrell. "Remarks to the effect that Merlin himself failed to do that, etc. Let us go straight to asking the important question. What the sweet slithering snakes was that?"
"The Patronus charm," Harry said. "Version 2.0.
"I rejoice to see that you are your usual self again," said Dumbledore. "But you are not going anywhere, young Ravenclaw, until you tell me what exactly was that warm and happy thought."
Said Harry. He tapped a contemplative finger on his cheek.
"I wonder if I should."
Professor Quirrell suddenly grinned.
"Please," said the headmaster. "Pretty, please. With sugar on top."
Harry felt an impulse and decided to go with it. It was dangerous, but there might not ever be a better opportunity until the end of time.
"Three sodas,"
Harry said to his pouch, then looked up at the defense professor and the headmaster of Hogwarts.
"Gentlemen," Harry said, "I bought these sodas on my first visit to Platform 9 3/4, on the day I entered into Hogwarts. I've been saving them for special occasions. There's a minor enchantment on them to ensure they're drunk at the right time. This is the last of my supply, but I do not think there will ever come a finer occasion. Shall we?"
Dumbledore took a soda can from Harry, and Harry tossed another to Professor Quirrell. The two older men each muttered identical charms over the can and frowned briefly at the result. Harry, for his part, simply popped the top and drank. The defense professor and the headmaster of Hogwarts politely followed suit. Harry said,
"I thought of my absolute rejection of death as the natural order."
It might not be the right kind of warm feeling you needed to cast a Patronus charm, but it was going into Harry's top 10 nonetheless. The looks he got from the defense professor and the headmaster briefly made Harry nervous as the spilled comma tea faded out of existence. But then the two of them each glanced at the other, and both apparently decided that they couldn't get away with doing anything really awful to Harry in the other's presence.
"Mr. Potter," said Professor Quirrell, "even I know that is not how things are supposed to work."
"Indeed,"
said Dumbledore.
"Explain."
Harry opened his mouth, and then, as realization hit him, rapidly snapped his mouth shut again. Godric hadn't told anyone, nor had Rowena, if she'd known. There might have been any number of wizards who'd figured it out and kept their mouths shut. You couldn't forget if you knew that was what you were trying to do. Once you realized how it worked, the animal form of the Patronus charm would never work for you again. And most wizards didn't have the right upbringing to turn on Dementors and destroy them.
Sorry about this," said Harry, "but I've just this instant realized that explaining would be an incredibly bad idea until you work some things out on your own."
"Is that the truth, Harry?"
Dumbledore said slowly.
"Or are you just pretending to be wise?"
"Headmaster,"
said Professor Quirrell, sounding genuinely shocked.
"Mr. Potter has told you that this spell is not spoken of with those who cannot cast it. You do not press a wizard on such matters."
"If I told you..." Harry began.
"No!"
Professor Quirrell said, sounding rather severe.
"You don't tell us why, Mr. Potter. You simply tell us that we are not to know. If you wish to devise a hint, you should do so carefully, at leisure, not in the midst of conversation."
Harry nodded.
"But," said the headmaster, what am I to tell the ministry? You can't just lose a Dementor." "Tell them I ate it,"
said Professor Quirrell, causing Harry to choke on the soda he had unthinkingly raised to his lips.
"I don't mind. Shall we head on back, Mr. Potter?"
The two of them began to walk the dirt path back to Hogwarts, leaving behind Albus Dumbledore staring forlornly at the empty cage and the three sleeping Aurors awaiting their memory charms.
Aftermath. Harry Potter and Professor Quirrell.
They walked for a while before Professor Quirrell spoke, and all background noise dropped into silence when he did.
"You are exceptionally good at killing things, my student," said Professor Quirrell.
Thank you," Harry said sincerely.
"I am not prying," said Professor Quirrell, "but on the off chance that it was only the headmaster who you did not trust with the secret."
Harry considered this. Professor Quirrell already couldn't cast the animal Patronus charm. But you couldn't untell a secret, and Harry was a fast enough learner to realize that he ought to at least think for a while before unleashing this one upon the world. Harry shook his head, and Professor Quirrell nodded acceptance.
"Out of curiosity, Professor Quirrell," said Harry, "if your bringing the Dementor to Hogwarts had been part of an evil plot, what would have been its goal?"
"Assassinate Dumbledore while he was weakened," Professor Quirrell said without even hesitating. "The headmaster told you he was suspicious of me?"
Harry said nothing for a second while he tried to think of a reply, and then gave up when he realized he'd already answered.
"Interesting," Professor Quirrell said. "Mr. Potter, it is not out of the question that there was a plot at work today. Your wand ending up that close to the Dementor's cage could have been an accident. Or one of the Aurors could have been imperious, confounded, or legitimized to exert an influence. Flitwick and myself should not be excluded as suspects in your calculation. One notes that Professor Snape cancelled all his classes today, and I suspect he is powerful enough to disillusion himself. The Aurors cast detection charms early on, but they did not repeat them immediately before your turn. But, most easily of all, Mr. Potter, the deed could have been plotted by Dumbledore himself. And if he did, why, he might also take steps in advance to cast your suspicion elsewhere."
They walked on for a few steps.
"But why would he?"
Harry said. The defense professor stayed quiet a moment and then said,
"Mr. Potter, what steps have you taken to investigate the headmaster's character?"
Not many, said Harry.
He'd only recently realized.
Not nearly enough.
Then I will observe, said Professor Quirrell, that you do not find out all there is to know about a man by asking only his friends.
Now it was Harry's turn to walk a few steps in silence on the slightly beaten dirt path that led back to Hogwarts. He had really been supposed to know better than that already. Confirmation bias was the technical term. It meant, among other things, that when you chose your information sources, there was a notable tendency to choose information sources that agreed with your current opinions.
Thank you, Harry said. Actually, I didn't say it earlier, did I? Thank you for everything. If another Dementor ever threatens you, or for that matter slightly annoys you, just let me know and I'll introduce it to Mr. Glowy Person. I don't like it when Dementors slightly annoy my friends.
That got him an indecipherable glance from Professor Quirrell.
You destroyed the Dementor because it threatened me?
Harry said. I'd sort of decided on it before then, but yes, that would have been sufficient reason by itself.
I see, said Professor Quirrell. And what would you have done about the threat to me if your spell hadn't worked for destroying the Dementor?
Plan B, said Harry. Encase the Dementor in dense metal with a high melting point, probably tungsten, drop it into an active volcano and hope it ends up inside Earth's mantle. The whole planet is filled with molten lava under its surface.
Yes, said Professor Quirrell. I know.
The defense professor was wearing a very odd smile.
I really should have thought of that myself, all things considered. Tell me, Mr. Potter, if you wanted to lose something where no one would ever find it again, where would you put it?
Harry considered this question.
I suppose I shouldn't ask you what you found that needs losing.
Quite, said Professor Quirrell, as Harry had expected.
And then?
Perhaps you will be told when you are older.
Which Harry hadn't.
Well, said Harry, besides trying to get it into the molten core of the planet, you could bury it in solid rock a kilometre underground in a randomly selected location. Maybe teleport it in, if there's some way to do that blindly. Or drill a hole and repair the hole afterward. The important thing would be not to leave any traces leading there, so it's just an anonymous cubic metre somewhere in the Earth's crust. You could drop it into the Mariana Trench. That's the deepest depth of ocean on the planet. Or just pick some random other ocean trench to make it less obvious. If you could make it buoyant and invisible, then you could throw it into the stratosphere. Or, ideally, you'd launch it into space with a cloak against detection and a randomly fluctuating acceleration factor that would take it out of the solar system. And afterward, of course, you'd obliviate yourself, so even you didn't know exactly where it was.
The defense professor was laughing, and it sounded even odder than his smile.
Professor Quirrell,
Harry said.
All excellent suggestions, said Professor Quirrell. But tell me, Mr. Potter, why those exact five?
Said Harry. They just seemed like the obvious sorts of ideas.
Oh, said Professor Quirrell. But there is an interesting pattern to them, you see. One might say it sounds like something of a riddle. I must admit, Mr. Potter, that although it has had its ups and downs, on the whole, this has been a surprisingly good day.
And they continued walking down the path that led to the gates of Hogwarts, quite some distance apart, as Harry, without even thinking about it, automatically stayed far enough away from the defense professor not to trigger that sense of doom, which for some reason seemed unusually strong right now.
Aftermath, Daphne Greengrass.
Hermione had refused to answer any questions, and as soon as they'd passed the split leading to the Slytherin dungeons, Daphne and Tracy had peeled off at once, walking as quickly as they could. Rumour travelled fast in Hogwarts, so they'd have to go to the dungeons right away if they wanted to be the first to tell everyone the story.
"Now, remember," said Daphne, "don't just blurt out about the kiss as soon as we walk in, okay? It works better if we tell the whole story in order."
Tracy nodded excitedly. As soon as they burst into Slytherin Common Room, Tracy Davis took a deep breath and shouted,
"Everyone! Harry Potter couldn't cast the Patronus Charm, and the Dementor almost ate him, and Professor Quirrell saved him, but then Potter was all evil until Granger brought him back with a kiss. It's true love, for sure!"
It was ordered storytelling, of a sort, Daphne supposed. The news failed to produce the expected reaction. Most of the girls glanced over and then stayed in their couches, or the boys simply kept reading in their chairs.
"Yes," said Pansy sourly from where she was sitting with Gregory's feet in her lap, leaning back and reading what seemed to be a colouring book.
"Millicent already told us."
"How?"
"Why didn't you kiss him first, Tracy?"
said Flora and Hestia Caro from their own chairs.
"Now Potter's going to marry a mudblood girl. You could have been his true love and gotten into a rich noble house and everything if you'd just kissed him first."
Tracy's face was a picture in stunned realization.
"What?"
shrieked Daphne.
"Love doesn't work like that."
"Of course it does,"
stated Millicent from where she was practicing some sort of charm while looking out a window at the swirling waters of the Hogwarts lake.
"First kiss gets the prince."
"It wasn't their first kiss,"
shouted Daphne.
"Hermione was already his true love. That's why she could bring him back."
Then Daphne realized what she'd just said and winced internally. But, as the saying went, you had to fit the tongue to the ear.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa! Whoa!"
said Gregory, swinging his feet off Pansy's lap.
"What's this? Miss Bulstrode didn't tell that part."
Everyone else was also looking at Daphne now.
"Oh, yeah," said Daphne. "Harry shoved her away and shouted, 'I told you, no kissing.' Then Harry screamed like he was dying, and Fawkes started singing to him. I'm not sure which of those happened first, actually."
"That doesn't sound like true love to me," said the Caro twins.
"That sounds like the wrong person kissed him."
"It was supposed to be me,"
whispered Tracy.
Her face was still stunned.
I was supposed to be his true love. Harry Potter was my general. Oh, he should have. I should have fought Granger for him.
Daphne spun on Tracy, incensed.
You take Harry away from Hermione?
Yeah,
said Tracy.
Me. You're nuts,
Daphne stated with conviction.
Even if you had kissed him first, you know what that would make you? The sad little love-struck girl who dies at the end of Act Two.
You take that back,
shouted Tracy. Meanwhile, Gregory had crossed the room to where Vincent was doing his homework.
Mr. Crabbe,
Gregory said in a low voice.
I think Mr. Malfoy needs to know about this.
Aftermath, Hermione Granger. Hermione stared at the wax-sealed paper, on the surface of which was inscribed simply the number 42.
I figured out why we couldn't cast the Patronus charm, Hermione. It doesn't have anything to do with us not being happy enough, but I can't tell you. I couldn't even tell the headmaster. It needs to be even more secret than partial transfiguration. For now, anyway. But if you ever need to fight Dementors, the secret is written here, cryptically, so that if someone doesn't know it's about Dementors and the Patronus charm, then they won't know what it means.
She'd told Harry about seeing him dying. Her parents dying. All her friends dying. Everyone dying. She hadn't told him about her terror of dying alone. Somehow, that was still too painful. Harry had told her about remembering his parents dying, and that he'd thought it was funny.
There's no light in the place the Dementor takes you, Hermione. No warmth. No caring. It's somewhere that you can't even understand happiness. There's pain and fear, and those can still drive you. You can hate and take pleasure in destroying what you hate. You can laugh when you see other people hurting. But you can't ever be happy. You can't even remember what it is that isn't there anymore. I don't think there's any way I can ever explain just what you saved me from. I'm usually ashamed to put people to trouble. I usually can't stand it when people make sacrifices for me. But this one time, I'll say that no matter what it ends up costing you to have kissed me, don't ever doubt for a second that it was the right thing to do.
Hermione hadn't realized how little the Dementor had touched her, how small and shallow had been the darkness into which it had taken her. She had seen everyone dying, and that had still been able to hurt. Hermione put the paper back into her pouch, like a good girl ought to do. She'd really wanted to read it, though. She was frightened of Dementors.
Aftermath, Minerva McGonagall.
She felt frozen. She shouldn't have been so shocked. She shouldn't have found Harry so hard to face. But after what he'd been through, she had searched the young boy in front of her for any signs of dementation, and failed to find them. But something about the calm with which he had asked such a foreboding question seemed deeply worrying.
Mr. Potter, I can't possibly speak of such matters without the headmaster's permission.
The boy in her office took this in without changing expression.
I would prefer not to disturb the headmaster over this matter,"
Harry Potter said calmly.
"I insist on not disturbing him, in fact, and you did promise that our conversation would be kept private. So, let me put it this way. I know that there was, in fact, a prophecy. I know that you are the one who originally heard it from Professor Trelawney. I know that the prophecy identified the child of James and Lily as someone dangerous to the Dark Lord. And I know who I am. Indeed, everyone now knows who I am. So, you are revealing nothing new or dangerous, if you tell me only this. What was the exact wording which identified me, the child of James and Lily?"
Trelawney's hollow voice echoed in her mind.
"Born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies."
"Harry,"
said Professor McGonagall,
"he can't possibly tell you that."
It chilled her to the bone that Harry knew so much already. She couldn't imagine how Harry had learned. The boy looked at her with strange, sorrowful eyes.
"Can you not sneeze without the headmaster's permission, Professor McGonagall? For I do promise to you that I have good reason to ask, and good reason to keep the question private."
"Please don't, Harry,"
she whispered.
"All right,"
Harry said.
"One simple question, please. Was the Potter family mentioned by name? Does the prophecy literally say Potter?"
She stared at Harry for a while. She couldn't have said why or where she got the sense that this was a critical point, that she could not lightly refuse the request, nor lightly accede to it.
"No,"
she finally said.
"Please, Harry, don't ask any more."
The boy smiled, a little sadly it seemed, and said,
"Thank you, Minerva. You are a good woman, and true."
And while her mouth was still open in utter shock, Harry Potter got up and left the office. And only then did she realize that Harry had taken her refusal as an answer, and the true answer at that. Harry closed the door behind himself. The logic had presented itself with a strange, diamond-like clarity. Harry couldn't have said if it had come to him during Fawkes's singing, or maybe even before. Lord Voldemort had killed James Potter. He had preferred to spare Lily Potter's life. He had continued his attack, therefore, with the sole purpose of killing their infant child. Dark Lords are not usually scared of infant children. So, there was a prophecy about Harry Potter being dangerous to Lord Voldemort, and Lord Voldemort had known that prophecy.
"I give you this rare chance to flee, but I will not trouble myself to subdue you, and your death here will not save your child. Step aside, foolish woman, if you have any sense in you at all."
Had it been a whim to give her that chance? But then Lord Voldemort would not have tried to persuade her. Had the prophecy warned Lord Voldemort against killing Lily Potter? Then Lord Voldemort would have troubled himself to subdue her. Lord Voldemort had been mildly inclined not to kill Lily Potter. The preference had been stronger than a whim, but not as strong as a warning. So, suppose that someone whom Lord Voldemort considered a lesser ally or servant, useful but not indispensable, had begged the Dark Lord to spare Lily's life. Lily's, but not James's. This person had known that Lord Voldemort would attack the house of the Potters, had known both the prophecy and the fact that the Dark Lord knew it. Otherwise he would not have begged Lily's life. According to Professor McGonagall, besides herself, the other two who knew of the prophecy were Albus Dumbledore and Severus Snape. Severus Snape, who had loved Lily before she was Lily Potter, and hated James. Severus, then, had learned of the prophecy and told it to the Dark Lord, which he had done because the prophecy had not described the Potters by name. It had been a riddle, and Severus had solved that riddle only too late. But if Severus had been the first to hear the prophecy, and disposed to tell it to the Dark Lord, then why would he also have told Dumbledore or Professor McGonagall? Therefore, Dumbledore or Professor McGonagall had heard it first. The headmaster of Hogwarts had no obvious reason to tell the Transfiguration Professor about an extremely sensitive and crucial prophecy. But the Transfiguration Professor had every reason to tell the headmaster. It seemed likely, then, that Professor McGonagall had been the first to hear it. The prior probabilities said that it had been Professor Trelawney, Hogwarts' resident seer. Seers were rare, so if you counted up most of the seconds Professor McGonagall had spent in the presence of a seer over the course of her lifetime, most of those seer seconds would be Trelawney seconds. Professor McGonagall had told Dumbledore, and would have told no one else about the prophecy without permission. Therefore, it was Albus Dumbledore who had arranged for Severus Snape to somehow learn of the prophecy, and Dumbledore himself had solved the riddle successfully, or he would not have selected Severus, who had once loved Lily, as the intermediary. Dumbledore had deliberately arranged for Lord Voldemort to hear about the prophecy, in hopes of luring him to his death. Perhaps Dumbledore had arranged for Severus to learn only some of the prophecy, or there were other prophecies of which Severus had remained innocent. Somehow, Dumbledore had known that an immediate attack on the Potters would still lead to Lord Voldemort's immediate defeat, although Lord Voldemort himself had not believed this. Or maybe that had just been a lucky stroke of Dumbledore's insanity, his taste for bizarre plots. Severus had ended up serving Dumbledore afterward. Perhaps the Death Eaters would not look kindly on Severus if Dumbledore revealed his role in their defeat. Dumbledore had tried to arrange for Harry's mother to be spared, but that part of his plot had failed, and he had knowingly condemned James Potter to his death. Dumbledore was responsible for the deaths of Harry's parents. If the whole chain of logic was correct, Harry could not, in justice, say that successfully ending the Wizarding War did not count as extenuating circumstances. But somehow, this still bothered him a great deal. And it was time, and past time, to ask Draco Malfoy what the other side of that war had to say about the character of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore. Chapter 47. Personhood Theory. There comes a point in every plot where the victim starts to suspect, and looks back, and sees a trail of events all pointing in a single direction. And when that point comes, Father had explained, the prospect of the loss may seem so unbearable, and admitting themselves tricked may seem so humiliating, that the victim will yet deny the plot, and the game may continue long after. Father had warned Draco not to do that again. First, though, he'd let Mr. Avery finish eating all of the cookies he'd swindled from Draco while Draco watched and cried. The whole lovely jar of cookies that Father had given him just a few hours earlier, for Draco had lost all of them to Mr. Avery, down to the very last one. So, it was a familiar feeling that Draco had felt in the pit of his stomach when Gregory told him about the kiss. Sometimes you looked back and saw things. In a lightless classroom, you couldn't quite call it unused anymore, since it had seen weekly use over the last few months, a boy sat enshrouded in a hooded cowl, with an unlightened crystal globe on the desk in front of him. Thinking in silence, thinking in darkness, waiting for an opening door to let in the light. Harry had shoved Granger away and said, "I told you, no kissing." Harry would probably say something like that.
"She just did it to annoy me last time, just like she made me go on that date."
But the verified story was that Granger had been willing to face the Dementor again in order to help Harry. That she had kissed Harry, crying when he was lost in the depths of dementation. And that her kiss had brought him back. That didn't sound like rivalry, even friendly rivalry. That sounded like the kind of friendship you usually didn't see even in plays. Then why had Harry made his friend climb the icy walls of Hogwarts? Because that was the sort of thing Harry Potter did to his friends. Father had told Draco that to fathom a strange plot, one technique was to look at what ended up happening, assume it was the intended result, and ask who benefited. What had ended up happening as the result of Draco and Granger fighting Harry Potter together was that Draco had started to feel a lot friendlier toward Granger. Who benefited from the Scion of Malfoy becoming friends with a mudblood witch? Who benefited that was famous for exactly that sort of plot? Who benefited that could possibly be pulling Harry Potter's strings? Dumbledore. And if that was true, then Draco would have to go to Father and tell him everything, no matter what happened after that. Draco couldn't imagine what would happen after that. It was awful beyond imagining, which made him want to cling desperately to the last shred of hope that it wasn't all what it looked like. Draco remembered that, too, from Mr. Avery's lesson. Draco hadn't planned to confront Harry yet. He was still trying to think of an experimental test, something that Harry wouldn't just see through and fake. But then, Vincent had come with the message that Harry wanted to meet early this week, on Friday instead of Saturday. And so, here Draco was, in a dark classroom, an unlit crystal globe on his desk, waiting. Minutes passed. Footsteps approached. The door made a gentle creak as it swung open into the classroom, revealing Harry Potter, dressed in his own hood and cowl. Harry stepped forward into the dark classroom, and the sturdy door closed behind him with a faint click. Draco tapped the crystal globe, and the classroom lit with bright green light. Green light projected shadows off the desks onto the floor, and glared back at him from the curved chair backs, photons bouncing off the wood in such fashion that the angle of incidence equaled the angle of reflection. At least that much of what he'd learned wasn't likely to be a lie. Harry had flinched as the light went on, halting for a moment, then resumed his approach.
"Hello, Draco,"
Harry said quietly, drawing back his hood as he came to Draco's desk.
"Thank you for coming. I know it's not our usual time."
"You're welcome,"
Draco said flatly. Harry dragged one of the chairs to face Draco across his desk, the legs making a slight screeching sound on the floor. He spun the chair so that it was facing the wrong way, and sat down straddling it, his arms folded across the back of the chair. The boy's face was pensive, frowning, serious, looking very adult, even for Harry Potter.
"I have an important question to ask you," said Harry. "But there's something else I want us to do before that."
Draco said nothing, feeling a certain weariness. Part of him just wanted it all to be over with already.
"Tell me, Draco," said Harry, "why don't Muggles ever leave ghosts behind when they die?"
"Because Muggles don't have souls, obviously," Draco said.
He didn't even realize until after he'd said it that it might contradict Harry's politics, and then he didn't care. Besides, it was obvious. Harry's face showed no surprise.
"Before I ask my important question, I want to see if you can learn the Patronus charm."
For a moment, the sheer non sequitur stumped Draco. Good old impossible to predict or understand Harry Potter. There were times when Draco wondered whether Harry was deliberately this disorienting as a tactic. Then Draco understood and shoved himself up and away from his desk in a single angry motion. That was it. It was over.
"Like Dumbledore's servants," he spat.
"Like Salazar Slytherin," Harry said steadily.
Draco almost stumbled over his own feet in the middle of his first stride toward the door. Slowly, Draco turned back toward Harry.
"I don't know where you came up with that," said Draco, "but it's wrong. Everyone knows the Patronus charm is a Gryffindor spell.
Salazar Slytherin could cast a corporeal Patronus charm," Harry said.
Harry's hand darted into his robes, brought out a book whose title was written as white on green and so almost impossible to read in the green light, but it looked old.
"I discovered that when I was researching the Patronus charm before, and I found the original reference and checked the book out at the library just in case you didn't believe me. The author of this book doesn't think there's anything unusual about Salazar being able to cast a Patronus either. The belief that Slytherins can't do that must be recent. And, as a further historical note, though I don't have the book with me, Godric Gryffindor never could."
After the first 6 times Draco had tried calling Harry's bluff, on 6 successively more ridiculous occasions, he'd realized that Harry just
didn't lie about what was written in books. Still, when Harry's hands opened the book and laid it out to the place of the bookmark, Draco leaned over and studied the place where Harry's finger pointed.
Then the fires of Ravenclaw fell upon the darkness that had cloaked the left wing of Lord Foul's army, breaking it, and it was revealed that the Lord Gryffindor had spoken true. The fear they'd all felt was not natural in its source, but coming from thrice a dozen Dementors, who had been promised the souls of the defeated. At once, the Lady Hufflepuff and Lord Slytherin brought forth their patronesses, a vast, angry badger, and a bright silver serpent, and the defenders lifted their heads as the shadow passed from their hearts. And Lady Ravenclaw laughed, remarking that Lord Foul was a great fool, for now his own army would be subject to the fear, but not the defenders of Hogwarts. Yet the Lord Slytherin said, "No fool he, that much I know." And the Lord Gryffindor beside him studied the battlefield with a frown upon his face.
Draco looked back up.
"So?"
Harry closed the book and put it into his pouch.
"Chaos and Sunshine both have soldiers that can cast corporeal Patronus charms. Corporeal Patronuses can be used to convey messages. If you can't learn the spell, a dragon army will be at a severe military disadvantage."
Draco didn't care about that right now and told Harry so. His voice was sharper than it probably should have been. Harry didn't blink.
"Then I'm calling in the favour you owe me from that time I stopped a riot from breaking out on our first day of broomstick lessons. I'm going to try to teach you the Patronus charm, and for my favour, I want you to do your honest best to learn and cast it. I trust to the honour of House Malfoy that you will."
Draco felt that certain weariness again. If Harry had asked at any other time, it would have been a fair return on a favour owed, given that it wasn't actually a Gryffindor spell. But
why?
Draco said.
"To find out whether you can do this thing that Salazar Slytherin could do,"
Harry said evenly.
"This is an experimental test, and I'll not tell you what it means until after you've done it. Will you?"
It probably was a good idea to discharge that favour on something innocuous, or the more so if it was time to break with Harry Potter.
"All right."
Harry drew a wand from his robes and laid it against the globe.
"Not really the best colour for learning the Patronus charm,"
Harry said.
"Green light. The exact shade of the killing curse, I mean. But silver is a Slytherin colour too, isn't it? Dulac."
The light went out, and Harry whispered the first two phrases of the continual light enchantment, recasting that part of it, though neither of them could have cast the whole thing by themselves. Then Harry tapped the globe again, and the room lit with a silver radiance. Brilliant, but still soft and gentle. Colour returned to the desks and chairs, and to Harry's slightly sweaty face beneath his shock of black hair. It took that long for Draco to realise the implication.
"You saw a killing curse cast since the last time we met? When? How?"
"Cast the Patronus charm,"
Harry said, looking more serious than ever.
"And I'll tell you."
Draco pressed his hands to his eyes, shutting out the silver light.
"You know, I really should remember that you're too weird for any normal plots."
Within his self-imposed darkness,
He heard the sound of Harry snickering. Harry watched closely as Draco finished his latest run-through of the preliminary gestures, the part of the spell that was difficult to learn. The final brandish and the pronunciation didn't have to be precise. All three of the last runs had been perfect as far as Harry could see. Harry had also felt an odd impulse to adjust things that Mr. Lupin hadn't said anything about, like the angle of Draco's elbow or the direction his foot was pointing. It could have been entirely his own imagination, and probably was, but Harry had decided to go with it, just in case.
"All right,"
Harry said quietly. There was a tension in his chest that made it a little too hard to speak.
"Now, we don't have a Dementor here, but that's all right. We don't need one. Draco, when your father spoke to me at the train station, he said that you were the one thing in the world that was most precious to him, and that he threatened to throw away all his other plans to take vengeance on me if ever you came to harm."
"He... what?" There was a catch in Draco's voice and a strange look on his face.
"Why are you telling me that?" "Why wouldn't I?"
Harry didn't let his expression change, though he could guess what Draco was thinking. That Harry had been plotting to separate Draco from his father and shouldn't be saying anything that would bring them closer together.
"There's always been just one person who matters most to you, and I know exactly what warm and happy thought will let you cast the Patronus charm. You told it to me at the train station before the first day of school. Once you fell off a broomstick and broke your ribs. It hurt more than anything you'd ever felt, and you thought you were going to die. Pretend that fear is coming from a Dementor, standing in front of you, wearing a tattered black cloak, looking like a dead thing left in water. And then cast the Patronus charm, and when you brandish the wand to drive the Dementor away, think of how your father held your hand so that you wouldn't be afraid. And then think of how much he loves you, and how much you love him, and put it all into your voice when you say Expecto Patronum. For the honor of House Malfoy, and not just because you promised me a favor, show me you didn't lie to me that day in the train station when you told me Lucius was a good father. Show me you can do what Salazar Slytherin could do."
And Harry stepped backward, behind Draco, out of Draco's field of vision, so that Draco only faced the dusty old teacher's desk and blackboard at the front of the unused classroom. Draco cast one look behind him, that strange look still on his face, and then turned away to face forward. Harry saw the exhalation, the inhalation. The wand twitched once, twice, thrice, and four times. Draco's fingers slid along the wand, exactly the right distances. Draco lowered his wand.
"This is too..."
Draco said.
"I can't think this right while you're watching."
Harry turned around and started walking toward the door.
"I'll come back in a minute," Harry said. "Just hold to your happy thought and the Patronus will stay."
From behind Draco came the sound of the door opening again. Draco heard Harry's footsteps entering the classroom, but Draco didn't turn to look. Harry didn't say anything either. The silence stretched. Finally,
"What does this mean?"
Draco said, His voice wavered a bit.
It means you love your father,
Harry's voice said, which was just what Draco had been thinking, and trying not to cry in front of Harry. It was too right. Just too right. Before Draco, on the floor, was the shining form of a snake that Draco recognized. A blue crate. A snake first brought to their manor by Lord Abraxas Malfoy after a visit to some faraway land, and Father had kept a blue crate in the Offidarium ever since. The thing about the blue crate was that the bite wouldn't hurt much. Father had said that, and told Draco that he was never allowed to pet the snake, no matter who was watching. The venom killed your nerves so fast that you didn't have time to feel pain as the poison spread. You could die of it, even after using healing charms. It ate other snakes. It was as Slytherin as any creature could possibly be. That was why a blue crate head had been forged into the handle of Father's cane. The bright snake darted out its tongue, which was also silver, and seemed to smile somehow in a warmer way than any reptile should. And then Draco realized.
But,
Draco said, still staring at the beautifully radiant snake.
You can't cast the Patronus charm?
Now that Draco had cast it himself, he understood why that was important. You could be evil, like Dumbledore, and still cast the Patronus charm, so long as you had something bright left inside you. But if Harry Potter didn't have a single thought inside him that shone like that...
The Patronus charm is more complicated than you think, Draco,
Harry said seriously.
Not everyone who fails at casting it is a bad person, or even unhappy. But, anyway, I can cast it. I did it on my second try, after I realized what I'd done wrong facing the Dementor my first time. But, well, my life gets a little peculiar sometimes, and my Patronus came out strange, and I'm keeping it a secret for now. Am I supposed to just believe that? You can ask Professor Quirrell if you don't believe me, said Harry. Ask him whether Harry Potter can cast a corporeal Patronus, and tell him I told you to ask. He'd know the request was from me. No one else would know.
Oh, and now Draco was to trust Professor Quirrell? Still, knowing Harry, it might be true. And Professor Quirrell wouldn't lie for trivial reasons. The glowing snake turned its head back and forth, as though seeking a prey that wasn't there, and then coiled itself into a circle, as though to rest.
I wonder, Harry said softly, when it was, which year, which generation, that Slytherin stopped trying to learn the Patronus charm. When it was that people started to think, that Slytherins themselves started to think, that being cunning and ambitious was the same as being cold and unhappy. And if Salazar knew that his students didn't even bother showing up to learn the Patronus charm anymore, I wonder... Would he wish that he'd never been born? I wonder how it all went wrong. When Slytherin's house went wrong.
The shining creature winked out, the turmoil rising in Draco making it impossible to sustain the charm. Draco spun on Harry. He had to control himself not to raise his wand.
What do you know about Slytherin House or Salazar Slytherin? You were never sorted into my house. What gives you the right to...
And that was when Draco finally realized.
You did get sorted into Slytherin, Draco said. You did! And afterwards, you somehow, you snapped your fingers.
Draco had once asked Father if it would be clever to get sorted into some other house so that everyone would trust him, and Father had smiled and said that he'd thought of that too at Draco's age, but there was no way to fool the Sorting Hat. Not until Harry Potter came along. How had he ever bought for 1 minute that Harry was a Ravenclaw?
An interesting hypothesis,
Harry said equably.
Do you know, you're the second person in Hogwarts to come up with a theory along those lines. At least you're the second that actually said so to my face.
Snape!
Draco said with certainty. His head of house was no fool.
Professor Quirrell, of course, said Harry. Though, come to think, Severus did ask me how I managed to stay out of his house, and whether I had something the Sorting Hat wanted. I suppose you could say you're number three. Oh, but Professor Quirrell's theory was a little different than yours, though. May I have your word, not to repeat it?
Draco nodded without even really thinking about it. What was he supposed to do? Say no?
Professor Quirrell thought that Dumbledore wasn't happy with the hat's choice for the boy who lived.
And the instant Harry said it, Draco knew. He knew that it was true. It was just obvious. Who did Dumbledore even think he was fooling? Well, besides every single other person in Hogwarts except Snape and Quirrell, Harry might even believe it himself. Draco stumbled back to his desk in something of a daze and sat down hard enough to hurt slightly. This sort of thing happened around once a month with Harry, and it hadn't happened yet in January, so it was about time. His fellow Slytherin, who might or might not think himself a Ravenclaw, sat back down in the chair he'd used earlier, now sitting on it crosswise and looking up intently at Draco. Draco didn't know what he should be doing now, whether he should be trying to persuade the lost Slytherin boy that, no, he wasn't actually a Ravenclaw, or trying to figure out whether Harry was in league with Dumbledore, though that suddenly seemed less likely. But then, why had Harry set up the whole thing with him and Granger? He really should have remembered that Harry was too weird for any normal plots.
Harry, Draco said, did you deliberately antagonize me and General Sunshine so we'd work together against you?
Harry nodded without hesitation, as though it was the most normal thing in the world and nothing to be ashamed of.
The whole thing with the gloves and making us climb up the walls of Hogwarts, the only point was to make me and Granger more friendly toward each other? And even before then, you've been plotting it for a really long time. Since the beginning.
Again, the nod.
Why?
Harry's eyebrows lifted for a moment, the only reaction he'd showed to Draco shrieking so loudly in the closed classroom that it hurt his own ears.
Why did Harry Potter do this sort of thing?
Then Harry said,
so that Slytherins will be able to cast the Patronus charm again.
That doesn't make sense!
Draco was aware that he was losing control of his voice, but he didn't seem able to stop himself.
What does that have to do with Granger?
Patterns,
Harry said. His face was very serious now, and very grave.
Like a quarter of children born to squib couples being wizards. A simple, unmistakable pattern you would recognize instantly if you knew what you were looking at, even though if you didn't know, you wouldn't even realize it was a clue. The poison in Slytherin House is something that's been seen before in the Muggle world. This is an advanced prediction, Draco. I could have written it down for you before our first day of school, just from hearing you talk in King's Cross Station. Let me describe some really pathetic sorts of people that hang around at your father's political rallies. Pure-blood families that would never be invited to dinner at Malfoy Manor. Bearing in mind that I've never met them, I'm just predicting it from recognizing the pattern of what's happening to Slytherin House.
And Harry Potter proceeded to describe the Parkinsons and Montagues and Bowles with a calmly cutting accuracy that Draco wouldn't have dared think to himself in case there was a Legilimens around. It was beyond insult. They would kill Harry if they ever heard.
To sum up, Harry finished, they don't have any power themselves. They don't have any wealth themselves. If they didn't have Muggleborns to hate, if all the Muggleborns vanished the way they say they want, they'd wake up one morning and find they had nothing. But so long as they can say pure bloods are superior, they can feel superior themselves. They can feel like part of the master class. Even though your father would never dream of inviting them to dinner. Even though there's not one galleon in their vaults. Even if they did worse on their OWLs than the worst muggle-born in Hogwarts. Even if they can't cast the Patronus charm anymore. Everything is the muggle-born's fault to them. They have someone besides themselves to blame for their own failures, and that makes them even weaker. That's what Slytherin House is becoming. Pathetic. And the root of the problem is hating Muggleborns.
Salazar Slytherin himself said that mudbloods need to be cast out, that they were weakening our blood.
Draco's voice had risen to a shout.
Salazar was wrong as a question of simple fact. You know that, Draco. And that hatred is poisoning your whole house. You couldn't cast the Patronus charm using a thought like that.
Then why could Salazar Slytherin cast the Patronus charm?
Harry was wiping sweat from his forehead.
Because things have changed between then and now. Listen, Draco. 300 years ago, you could find great scientists, as great as Salazar in their own way, who would have told you that some other muggles were inferior because of their skin colour.
Skin colour?
Said Draco.
I know. Skin colour instead of anything important like blood purity. Isn't it ridiculous? But then, something in the world changed. And now you can't find any great scientists who still think skin colour should matter. Only loser people like the ones I described to you. Salazar Slytherin made the mistake when everyone else was making it. Because He grew up believing it, not because he was desperate for someone to hate. There were a few people who did better than everyone else around them, and they were exceptionally good. But the ones who just accepted what everyone else thought weren't exceptionally evil. The sad fact is that most people just don't notice a moral issue at all unless someone else is pointing it out to them. And once they're as old as Salazar was when he met Godric, they've lost the ability to change their minds. Only then, Hogwarts was built, and Hogwarts started sending acceptance letters to Muggleborns like Godric insisted, and more people began to notice that Muggleborns weren't any different. Now it's a big political issue instead of something that everyone just believes without thinking about it. And the correct answer is that Muggleborns aren't any weaker than purebloods. So, now, the people who end up siding with what Salazar once believed are either people who grew up in very closed pureblood environments, like you, or people who are so pathetic themselves that they're desperate for someone to feel superior to. People who love to hate. That doesn't sound right,
Draco's voice said. His ears listened and wondered that he couldn't come up with anything better to say.
It doesn't? Draco, you know now there's nothing wrong with Hermione Granger. You had trouble dropping her off a roof, I hear. Even though you knew she'd taken a feather-falling potion. Even though you knew she was safe. What sort of person do you think wants to kill her? Not for any wrong she did to them, just because she's a Muggleborn. Even though she's just a young girl who would help them with their homework in a second if they ever asked her.
Harry's voice broke.
What sort of person wants her to die?
Father.
Draco felt split in two. He seemed to be having a problem with dual vision. Granger is a mudblood. She should die. And a girl hanging from his hand on the rooftop. Like, seeing double. Seeing double.
And anyone who doesn't want Hermione Granger to die won't want to hang around the sort of people who do. That's all people think Slytherin is now. Not clever planning. Not trying to achieve greatness. Just hating Muggleborns. I paid Morag a sickle to ask Padma why she hadn't gone to Slytherin. We both know she got the option. And Morag told me that Padma just gave her a look and said that she wasn't Pansy Parkinson. You see, the best students with the virtues of more than one house, the students with choices, they go under the hat thinking anywhere but Slytherin. And someone like Padma ends up in Ravenclaw. And I think the Sorting Hat tries to maintain a balance in the sorting. So it fills out the ranks of Slytherin with anyone who isn't repelled by all the hatred. So, instead of Padma Batil, Slytherin gets Pansy Parkinson. She's not very cunning, and she's not very ambitious, but she's the sort of person who doesn't mind what Slytherin's turning into. And the more Padmas go to Ravenclaw, and the more Pansies go to Slytherin, the more the process accelerates. It's destroying Slytherin House, Draco!
It had a ring of awful truth. Padma had belonged in Slytherin. And instead, Slytherin got Pansy. Father rallied lesser families like the Parkinsons because they were convenient sources of support. But Father hadn't realized the consequences of associating Slytherin's name with them.
I can't,
Draco said, but he wasn't even sure what he couldn't do.
What do you want from me?
I'm not sure how to heal Slytherin House,
Harry said slowly.
But I know it's something you and I will end up having to do. It took centuries for science to dawn over the Muggle world. It only happened slowly. But the stronger science got, the further that sort of hatred retreated.
Harry's voice was quiet now.
I don't know exactly why it worked that way, but that's how it happened historically. As though there's something in science, like the shine of a Patronus charm, driving back all sorts of darkness and madness. Not right away, but it seems to follow wherever science goes. The Enlightenment, that was what it was called in the Muggle world. It has something to do with seeking the truth, I think. With being able to change your mind from what you grew up believing. With thinking logically. Realizing that there's no reason to hate someone because their skin is a different color. Just like there's no reason to hate Hermione Granger. Or maybe there's something to it that even I don't understand. But the Enlightenment is something that you and I belong to now. Both of us. Fixing Slytherin House is just one of the things we have to do.
Let me think,
Draco said, his voice coming out in something of a croak.
Please?
He rested his head in his hands and thought. Draco thought for a while with his palms over his eyes to shut out the world. No sound but his and Harry's breathing. All the persuasive reasonableness of what Harry said, the evident grains of truth that it contained, and against that, the obvious, the perfectly and entirely obvious hypothesis about what was really going on. After a time, Draco finally raised his head.
It sounds right,
Draco said quietly. A huge smile broke out on Harry's face.
So?
Draco continued.
Is this where you bring me to Dumbledore to make it official?
He kept his voice very casual as he said it.
Oh, yeah, Harry said. That was the thing I was going to ask you about, actually.
Draco's blood froze in his veins. Froze solid and shattered.
Professor Quirrell said something to me that got me thinking. And, well, no matter how you answer this question, I'm already stupid for having not asked you a lot earlier. Everyone in Gryffindor thinks Dumbledore is a saint. The Hufflepuffs think he's crazy. The Ravenclaws are all proud of themselves for having worked out that he's only pretending to be crazy. But I never asked anyone in Slytherin. I'm supposed to know better than to make that sort of mistake. But if even you think Dumbledore's okay to conspire with on fixing Slytherin House, I guess I didn't miss anything important.
You know,
Draco said, his voice remarkably calm, all things considered.
Every time I wonder if you do things like this just to annoy me, I tell myself that it has to be accidental. No one could possibly do this sort of thing on purpose, even if they tried until blood trickled out of their ears. That's the only reason I'm not going to strangle you now. Huh?
And then strangle himself, because Harry had grown up with Muggles, and then Dumbledore had smoothly diverted him from Slytherin to Ravenclaw. So, it was perfectly plausible that Harry might not know anything, and Draco had never thought to tell him. Or else, Harry had guessed that Draco wouldn't join up with Dumbledore so readily, and this itself was just the next step of Dumbledore's plan. But if Harry really didn't know about Dumbledore, then warning him had to take precedence over everything.
All right,
Draco said after he had had a chance to organize his thoughts.
I don't know where to start, so I'll just start somewhere.
Draco drew a deep breath. This was going to take a while.
Dumbledore murdered his little sister and got away with it because his brother wouldn't testify against him.
Harry listened with increasing worry and dismay. Harry had been prepared, he thought, to take the blood purist side of the story with a grain of salt. The trouble was that, even after you added an enormous amount of salt, it still didn't sound good. Dumbledore's father had been convicted of using unforgivable curses on children and died in Azkaban. Well, that was no sin of Dumbledore's, but it would be a matter of public record. Harry could check that part and see whether all of this had been made up out of thin air by blood purists. Dumbledore's mother had died mysteriously, shortly before his younger sister died in what the Aurors had ruled to be murder. Supposedly, that sister had been brutalized by Muggles and never spoken again after that, which, Draco pointed out, sounded remarkably like a botched obliviation. After Harry's first few interruptions, Draco had seemed to pick up on the general principle and was now presenting the observations first and the inferences afterward.
"So, you don't have to take my word for it," said Draco. "You can see it, right? Anyone in Slytherin can. Dumbledore waited to fight his duel with Grindelwald until the exact moment when it would look best for Dumbledore. After Grindelwald had ruined most of Europe and built up a reputation as the most terrible dark wizard in history. And just when Grindelwald had lost the gold and blood sacrifices he was getting from his Muggle pawns and was about to start heading downhill. If Dumbledore was really the noble wizard he pretended to be, he'd have fought Grindelwald long before that. Dumbledore probably wanted Europe ruined. It was probably part of their plan together. He only attacked Grindelwald after his puppet failed him. And that big, flashy jewel wasn't real. There's no way two wizards would be so exactly matched that they'd fight for 20 whole hours until one of them fell over from exhaustion. That was just Dumbledore making it look more spectacular.
Here, Draco's voice became more indignant.
And that got Dumbledore made chief warlock of the Wizengamot. The line of Merlin unbroken, corrupted after 1500 years. And then he became Supreme Mugwump on top of that, and he already had Hogwarts to use as an invincible fortress. headmaster and chief warlock and supreme mugwump, no normal person would try to do all that at once. How can anyone not see that Dumbledore's trying to take over the world? Pause,
Harry said, and closed his eyes to think. It wasn't any worse than what you'd have heard about the West in Stalin's Russia, and none of that would have been true. Though the blood purists wouldn't be able to get away with making stuff up entirely, nor would they. The Daily Prophet had shown a pronounced tendency to make stuff up. But then again, when they stuck out their neck too far on the Weasley betrothal, they had been called on it, and they had been embarrassed. Harry opened his eyes and saw that Draco was watching him with a steady, waiting gaze.
So, when you asked me if it was time to join up with Dumbledore, that was just a test.
Draco nodded.
And before that, when you said it sounded right?
It sounds right, said Draco, but I don't know if I can trust you. Are you going to complain about me testing you, Mr. Potter? Are you going to say that I fooled you? That I led you on?
Harry knew he should smile like a good sport, but he couldn't really. It was too much of a disappointment.
You're right. It's fair. I can't complain,
Harry said instead.
So what about he who must not be named? Not as bad as he was made out to be?
Draco looked bitter at that.
So, you think it's all just making Father's side look good and Dumbledore's side look bad, and that I believe it all myself just because Father told me?
It's a possibility I'm considering,
Harry said evenly. Draco's voice was low and intense.
They knew. My father knew. His friends knew. They knew the Dark Lord was evil. But he was the only chance anyone had against Dumbledore. The only wizard anywhere who was powerful enough to fight him. Some of the other Death Eaters were truly evil too, like Bellatrix Black. Father isn't like that, but Father and his friends had to do it, Harry. They had to. Dumbledore was taking over everything. The Dark Lord was the only hope anyone had left.
Draco was staring hard at Harry. Harry met the gaze, trying to think. Nobody ever thought of themselves as the villain of their own story. Maybe Lord Voldemort did. Maybe Bellatrix did. But Draco certainly didn't. That the Death Eaters were bad guys was not in question. The question was whether they were the bad guys. Whether there was one villain in the story, or two.
You're not convinced, Draco said.
He looked worried and a little angry, which didn't surprise Harry. He was pretty sure Draco himself believed all this.
Should I be convinced?
Harry said. He didn't look away.
Just because you believe it? Are you a strong enough rationalist now that your belief is strong evidence to me? Because you'd be very unlikely to believe it if it weren't true. When I met you, you weren't that strong. Everything you told me, did you rethink it after you awakened as a scientist? Or is it just something you grew up believing? can you look me in the eyes and swear to me upon the honour of House Malfoy that if there's one untruth buried in what you said, one thing that got added on just to make Dumbledore look a little worse, you would have noticed?
Draco started to open his mouth, and Harry said,
Don't stain the honour of House Malfoy. You're not that strong yet, and you should know it. Listen, Draco, I've started to notice some worrying things myself, but there's nothing definite, nothing certain. It's all just deductions and hypotheses and untrustworthy witnesses. And there's nothing certain in your story either. Dumbledore might have had some other good reason not to fight Grindelwald years earlier, though it would have to be a pretty good excuse, especially considering what was happening on the Muggle side of things. But still, is there one clearly evil thing that Dumbledore's done for certain, so I don't have to wonder?
Draco's breathing was harsh.
All right,
Draco said in an uneven voice.
I'll tell you what Dumbledore did.
From Draco's robes came a wand, and Draco said,
Quietus!
Then,
Quietus!
Again, but he got the pronunciation wrong a second time, and finally Harry took out his own wand and did it.